On the homework, there's always a meditation assignment. It takes 15 minutes in the morning. Most people never do it. You're supposed to write the date and the time that you did your meditation. I don't care if you miss one a week or two a week because you got up late for work, okay? But you must fill that out and you must do it. If you don't do it, you fail the homework and after two of those, you're out of the class. I'm going to be very strict this time about it. People, if you're doing a tunduk and a dake, then it comes, you can do that during the part about the yinde ngangde, the mental and verbal recitation. It goes in there, okay?
What do you mean it goes in?
Whatever meditation I've assigned you, you can do during that point, at that point in the dake. So no excuse for people doing dakes, alright? And I'm going to be more strict about that. Then there'll be we're going to have a board meeting of the board of this group. I believe people here on it are, Anila's on it, I don't remember his name. I think it's Margie, Ernst, Anila, Michael, Rick, and you. And then that board will change every year, and we'll have elections after this board finishes. Probably we'll have a rule that to be a member, a legal member, you should have to have finished three courses, which I think a lot of you have. All right, and that's all. You can go on to the next page, class syllabus. And I'll just go over with you quickly what you're going to be subjected to. In the first class, we're going to cover where did the book come from, who wrote the explanations, what's the meaning of the title, and what were the circumstances under which the Buddha taught this book that you're about to study. Class 2, we're going to talk about how emptiness relates to bodhicitta, which is the wish for enlightenment. Why do they go together? Class 3, emptiness and the bodies of a Buddha. Okay? When you become a Buddha, you get like 4 bodies. Some books say 3. And we're going to talk about how emptiness relates to that. This is, by the way, the order in which the Diamond Cutter Sutra covers them. Class 4, the Buddha in the Diamond Sutra discusses the future of his own teachings. And we'll be covering that. Class 5, how do emptiness and karma interrelate? Right, that's a very important subject. Some people think if everything's empty, they can do what they want. And some people think that they should keep morality carefully and emptiness is ridiculous. So those are both extremes. And we'll try to study about how emptiness and karma actually go together. Class 6 is very important. That's about Tonglen, path of seeing. That's the stage, that's the experience at which you first perceived emptiness directly, which is it's probably the most important moment in a person's practice. And we're going to discuss that experience in detail. Number 7 is, how does emptiness relate to getting rid of your mental afflictions, your bad thoughts? Right? And that's very important. How does emptiness relate to becoming an arhat and reaching nirvana? Number 8 is emptiness and paradise. How does emptiness relate to gaining a Buddhist paradise? And how does emptiness relate to purification or cleaning yourself of bad karma? Number 9 is emptiness and the perfection of wisdom. You're going to get the definition of the perfection of wisdom and study that and see why even it has to be empty. And then we're going to talk about the two extremes. Number 10 is very important. Even though things are empty, they do function and they do matter. And we're going to cover that in detail. Class 11, at the end of the Diamond Cutter Sutra, is a very famous poem. 4 lines. It's Kama Ribde Mame Dagimasim Bhikavitam Nilamotam Tundabu Duje Chunam Dedakta. And all monks have to recite it at every monk ceremony. It's very famous. Very beautiful. So we'll cover that. We'll cover that poem and its meaning as far as impermanence and emptiness. And then you get your review for your final exam. Okay? And then class 12 will be final exam. Final exam will be exactly 1 week after the review. And I'm not going to let you take the exam when you want to, because some are still lingering from last fall. The only thing permanent is the exams. That'll be exactly that. I don't promise that we'll end. Next page. The next page is, the next few pages, the first two of them, which is refuge, and the next is offering the mandala. These are the things we recite before class to give the teaching. And that mandala represents the whole earth. And at the end of the mandala, you pray that that earth could become a paradise for all living beings. So actually, you're doing bodhicitta at the same time. So that's a great. Those two are before class. I think I got the order wrong here. Okay, subject of your class is this. Say Vajra.
Vajra.
Chedika.
Chedika.
Vajra.
Vajra.
Chedika.
Chedika.
Vajra means what? You know?
Diamond.
Diamond. Okay. Diamond. Ched is a. This, by the way, this is the Sanskrit name. All right, not the Tibetan name. Ched means to cut something. Cut. And ikka is just an ending. So Vajracchedika means diamond cutter. And that's the name of the book you're going to study. It's a sutra, which means it was taught by an enlightened being. Okay? It was taught by the Buddha. A Buddha. Okay? If something is a sutra, it's taught by a Buddha. There's some other teachings called sutras, but they're not really sutras, like the Vinaya Sutra. But normally sutra means taught by an enlightened being. So we're going to study the Vajracchedika Sutra, okay? Taught by Lord Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, 500 BC. And in Tibetan, the name is this. Say Dorje.
Dorje.
Dorje. Chöpa.
Chöpa.
Dorje.
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 Chöpa.
Chöpa. You've heard the word Dorje a lot if you, you know, if you've been around Tibetan Buddhism at all. Okay, Dorje means diamond. The Do part means stone. Do means stone. Je means Lord. So Dorje means Lord of Stones, King of Stones. The king of all stones is the diamond, okay? Dorje. And Chöpa again means to cut. To cut. You've had, I think, Getsa Chöpa before, cutting that virtue root. Remember, we had it in the Karma course. Same verb, okay, to cut something. So the name of the book is Dorje Chöpa.
Michael, is this modern Tibetan or is this ancient Tibetan when you say Tibetan?
Tibetan hasn't changed much since they started writing it about 1,100 years ago. Okay? It's changed very little. If you can read scripture, you can probably read a newspaper, roughly.
So the spoken is different.
Yeah, much different. So there's three or four Tibetans. You don't want to know. Okay, so Dorje Chöpa is the name of the book. Spoken by Lord Buddha about 500 BC. It was the first printed book in history. The Chinese edition around 800 was the first printed book. First book used printing and not manuscript writing. So it's been a very, very important book in China, Japan, and Mongolia. It was first translated into Chinese in the 4th century, in the 300s, by Kumara Yuryanja. And it's been very important in China. The Mongolians, and even the Mongolians that I live with, still keep a copy in their house. It's one of the only two books that every Mongolian keeps in their house. They call it Jodba, which is from the Chöpa. And it's been considered very important. It's been considered the most, either the most or one of the most important sutras studied in the Far East. In Tibet, it's not studied per se in the monasteries by itself, but it's still considered one of the most important sutras. There are two Indian explanations to this sutra. Okay, two Indian, ancient Indian pandits wrote explanations. The first one was Asanga. He wrote an explanation of this sutra. It's in the Tengir, it's in the Buddhist canon. It doesn't look like at that time this was called the Dorje Chöpa, the diamond cutter. It was called the 300, the perfection of wisdom in 300. And I used the computer, I counted the lines, it was 1,200 lines. That means 300 verses, although it's not in verse, but it was still called the 300 shlokas. Okay. And then there's a commentary by Master Kamalashila. Kamalashila. Say Kamalashila.
Kamalashila.
Okay. He's very famous because mostly because of the debate he had in Tibet. He did reach Tibet. He did teach in Tibet. He was invited to Tibet to engage in a debate. The Tibetans weren't sure how to meditate. And this was when they were first becoming Buddhists. So there was a viewpoint that was brought in from China, which was called Qiyangme, which means think about nothing. They believed that during meditation you should seek to just clear your mind of all thoughts and not think about anything. And that was taught by a teacher named Huashang. And Kamalashila represented the traditional Indian viewpoint, which was that meditation should have some content. And that when you go into meditation, you can do a review meditation, you can do a meditation on an outline, you can do a meditation which involves logic, or you can do a meditation which involves fixing the mind on a visualized picture or on a philosophical concept. But in any of those cases, the mind should be focused on some good object, some meaningful object. So the Chinese representative and the Kamalashila had a famous debate in the court of the Tibetan king. And Kamalashila won out. And the old-time debates, as I think Lee and Ariel were at the Explorers Club, right? The old-time debates were very serious. The winner's position would become the position of the whole country. And the loser would be banned. And Huashang was banned from Tibet. And that viewpoint was banned from Tibet. So that's ever since then, Tibetans have believed in Kamalashila's viewpoint. So in that sense, he's very important. His commentary is very long. It's mostly reflects the views of the mind-only school. He was a great scholar of that. Those are the only two Indian commentaries. Say Jone.
Jone.
Jarpa.
Jarpa.
Shidu.
Shidu.
Jone.
Jone.
Jarpa.
Jarpa.
Shidu.
Shidu.
Okay. This is Dharpa Shedup was a famous scholar from Chone. Chone is in Amdo. Amdo is in East Tibet. Okay. I think they say that there's three great regions of Tibet, the Kham, Amdo, and Utsang. The people from Utsang are great scholars, the people from Kham are great warriors, and I think the people from Amdo are supposed to be great salesmen or something. he was a very great lama, a very, very great scholar. He wrote about 12 volumes. His collected works are about 12 volumes. And he was from the greatest Tibetan monastery of all.
Saramin?
Yeah. Which is, happens to be my home monastery. He was from Saramin Monastery. Saramin is part of one of the three great monasteries in Lhasa. There were about 10,000 monks there up until 1959. 100 of them survived the Chinese invasion. 100 of them reached India. 107, sorry. So he was from Saramin Monastery. He has written the only commentary in Tibetan to the Diamond Sutra. Tibetans have written probably about 150,000 commentaries. And so far, we haven't been able to locate any other commentary. And this one was very exciting. We located it in St. Petersburg. It was missing. And we found it during the cataloging of the materials in St. Petersburg. So this has just been rediscovered. This has just been found. We knew that it existed, but we thought that all the copies had been burned. All the copies were kept in the Sarah Monastery Library, and that was hit by a direct hit by an artillery shell and burned. We didn't want other people to see the commentary and then it ended up to be a stupid thing. So we lost all the copies, and it took about 40 years to find one. So you're very fortunate. We're going to study the newly rediscovered, the only Tibetan commentary. And it's a really great commentary. It's about 40 pages long. And it's very good detail. And otherwise, the Diamond Sutra is pretty hard to read. It sounds a little crazy. You know, it keeps repeating itself. And if you don't know what's going on, you think, oh, people must have just added things on over the years and things like that. It's not like that. It has a very concrete structure. And Dharpa Shedup, he really defines that structure very well. So you're going to get readings from this commentary. and from the original. And that's about the only way you could ever study the Diamond Sutra, deep in Tibetan. The Sanskrit commentaries, the one by Kamala Shila, is very long, very difficult. I think it would be very hard to get through it. It's very high philosophy and hard to study. We do have the Sanskrit text of the Diamond Cutter Sutra, and it's available. There, two editions were found, and we have those. So we can check the Sanskrit when we need to. Okay.
Michael, what was this commentary called?
That's on your homework, by the way. the short name is Sunlight on the Path to Freedom. And it means, like, suppose you're in the dark and you don't know where to go, and then suddenly the sun suddenly popped up in the sky and the whole day came and you could see exactly where to go. That's the idea. If you didn't have the commentary, it would be very, very hard to understand the Diamond Cutter Sutra. With the commentary, it's like having the sun suddenly rise up in the sky and you can see everything. And it's very, very clear. Say Prajna Paramita.
Prajna Paramita.
Okay. This is Sanskrit for Perfection of Wisdom. This is the general name for all of the books which teach about emptiness. And the Diamond Cutter Sutra is one of them. The Diamond Cutter Sutra belongs to the group of books called Prajnaparamita. It's one of the Prajnaparamita books, which means perfection of wisdom. It's the sixth perfection. We had the definition. I don't know if anybody remembers it. Anybody remember the definition of Prajnaparamita? Techen Sangye Disambe Tomi Tomi Topinishi.
That wisdom which takes you up to Nirvana?
Nah. Don't remember? We had it a while back, a couple courses ago. It's the perception of emptiness under the influence of bodhicitta. It's the perception of emptiness under the influence of bodhicitta.
Denba.
Dendam? Denba. Dendam Denba. Dendam means ultimate, and Denba means truth, ultimate truth, which is the same thing as emptiness. So the word diamond and the idea of a diamond represents ultimate truth, represents emptiness. Why? You have to get in. You have to explain that. This relates to the path of seeing. What happens on the path of seeing? The path of seeing, which is the... There's five levels that you go through in your career, in your spiritual career. You reach the first level when you gain pure renunciation, true renunciation. When you truly are fed up with this life in a really deep way, profound way, and you really want to get out of it, get out of the bad parts, that's when you reach the first of the five paths. You reach the second of the five paths when you start to understand emptiness intellectually. Okay? Having gained renunciation, when you start to understand emptiness very well intellectually, you've reached the second path, and there's four levels inside that. Then comes a big moment in your career, right? It's called the path of seeing, third path. Path, by the way, just means realization. In Buddhism, Lam, Tokpa, Wuntho, Dzogchen, they're all the same. Right? Realization, understanding, path all mean the same thing. Definition of a path is a realization. Okay, when you reach the path of seeing, it's like, I say it's like losing your virginity, okay, but it's a different thing. It only happens once in your mental stream over the period of eternity. You have been alive, according to Buddhism, you've had a mind for time with no beginning. Your mind has existed for all eternity back into the past. There's no first moment of your mind. Your mind is timeless. Your mind has existed, I say it's like the big spaghetti noodle, but it never stops. It's back into the past, okay? Your mind will also continue into the future endlessly. We proved it in the fourth course when we tried. some people say I didn't prove it. Okay. At any rate, your mind is beginningless and it's going to be endless. Even after Buddhahood, your mind continues. Okay? You will become enlightened, your mind will never end. And the path of seeing, that third path, occurs once. It only occurs once. And before that moment, you're considered, it's called Chiba. Chiba means infant, Pratakyana in Sanskrit. You are considered a child. And after that moment, you are what's called an Arya. That defines an Arya. Arya means realized being. Okay? Not an enlightened being, but you are realized. Because you've realized the most important thing. So that moment is going to be a big milestone in your countless lives. It only happens once. And it happens through the influence of teaching. You reach a stage of very ripeness through the process of going through correct Buddhist teaching. Someone teaches you clearly the meaning of emptiness. And specifically, they cover all the necessary points for you to understand emptiness. And it's like a big threshold. It's like a big blister bursting. You know, you get more and more teaching. Assuming clear teaching and not, there are countless wrong teachings on emptiness, not just in the West. In Tibetan history, there have been countless wrong teachings. In Sanskrit books of Buddhism, there were countless mistaken or incomplete teachings on emptiness. If you get a good teaching on emptiness, and you follow that teaching, you think about it, you contemplate on it carefully, you meditate on it, okay, you reach a sort of a threshold. You go into a deep meditation. It has to be a deep meditation. And then you perceive emptiness directly. And then you've reached the path of seeing. During that time that it goes on, it might be 3-4 minutes. You're not aware of anything except the emptiness. You cannot be. Because emptiness, we cannot perceive emptiness and this room at the same time. They are completely different objects. So while you're perceiving emptiness, you can't perceive any other object. You don't even realize you're perceiving emptiness. Because you are not an ultimate object. You're also a non-ultimate object. So while that's going on, you're not aware of even yourself perceiving emptiness. Then you come out of that, and you reach the second half of the path of seeing. Second half of the path of seeing takes maybe half an hour. And you perceive, you understand that what you just did. You understand that it's correct and that you're not hallucinating. You understand that what you saw is actually the body of the Buddha. It's the Dharmakaya. It's the Dharma. It is one of the parts of the Buddha. You understand that. Then you go through the Four Noble Truths, okay? The Four Arya Truths. You understand clearly that you really have had countless past lives. You understand how many lives it will take for you to become enlightened, and you understand what you will be like when you become enlightened. You understand what it will be like. You understand exactly how many births it's going to take. 7 births is typical. And you understand that during those 7 births, you will have no problems. You'll always meet Dharma teachers. You'll have pleasant lives. You'll be wealthy. You won't have any major problems during those 7 births. You perceive that the tankas, the correct tankas, really do represent the body of the Buddha. And after that, you respect them in that way. And you also perceive that the truth of the Buddhist teachings, the correct sutras, the canon, is totally correct. You know, it turns out you're in the right religion. I mean, not to put down other religions, but at that moment, you perceive the truth of that. You perceive that you know, by good luck, whatever, you've met a tradition which is totally correct. The books are totally correct. And you get this mania for protecting the books. You must protect them, you must keep them in the world. Must keep those teachings pure and must transmit them to the next generation. Very important. Okay. These all go on during the path, right after the path of seeing. It's called Jetabyeshi. It's a kind of wisdom. And all of those perceptions constitute the four Arya truths. Arya truths meaning they were triggered by your perception of emptiness. Okay. That's the only time you perceive the real nature of the four Arya truths. It's the first time you perceive the real nature of the four Arya truths. And that's why they're called the four Arya truths. The word noble is a bad translation, or it's a translation of Arya. And an Arya is a person who's seen emptiness directly. That all goes on during the moments after the path of seeing. One very important realization you get at that moment is that there's no worldly representation of emptiness. Nothing can approach it. There's been no object in your experience which is like emptiness. Totally different object. It's ultimate. But the closest thing is a diamond. The very closest thing is a diamond, for many reasons. Okay, diamond is clear, and it'd be expensive, but if you could make a wall of diamond around yourself, and if it were oriented correctly, if you were looking straight into the diamond, you couldn't see it. You wouldn't be able to see it. So there could be a diamond wall all around you, and you could look through it and you wouldn't see it. Okay, that's the first meaning of diamond. Okay, diamond represents ultimate truth because it's totally clear. And what it means is emptiness is around you all the time. Every single object in the universe has emptiness as one of its qualities. And we'll get into that. We'll explain why. Every single object in the universe has its own emptiness. So there's emptiness been going around you all the time. You are empty, and your mind is empty. It's been around you all the time. You have not ever seen it directly, if you're not an Aryan. And I don't know who in this room might be an Aryan. Okay, that's another point. I don't have an ability to read your mind right now. So, could be all of you are, could be none of you are. Could be one of us, could be more, I don't know. But it's all around you and you've never seen it if you're not an Aryan. Okay, emptiness is part of every object. Every object has its own emptiness. And it's been around you since you were a little baby and you never saw it. That's the first meaning of the diamond. Second thing is that a diamond is ultimate in the sense that physically it's the hardest thing in the universe. Nothing can scratch a diamond. That's just a physical reality. There's nothing in the universe that can scratch a diamond. You can split a diamond. You can rub a diamond with another diamond and make it into the shape that you think of as a diamond. But nothing can scratch a diamond. It isn't close to being an ultimate. It's not a real ultimate. That's the second meaning of diamond. Third meaning of diamond is that if you cut a diamond, diamond is pure carbon. I mean, they knew it, the Buddha knew it. It's totally pure atomically. It's a totally perfect relationship. That's why pencil lead, which is pure carbon, rubs off in little layers as you write on a piece of paper. It just slides off. Its structure is imperfect, but a diamond structure is totally perfect inside. Which means if you smash a diamond, which you can do, every little piece of that diamond is pure diamond. And that's very important. Okay. Every piece, it's called Dorje Sekma in Buddhist philosophy. Every piece of a diamond is as pure as every other piece. Totally pure. It's not like one part of a diamond is more pure than another. Every piece of diamond is totally pure diamond. That's the nature of a diamond. And that's similar to ultimate reality. Ultimate truth or emptiness, the emptiness of every object is totally equivalent. And we'll get into that. It's one of the points in the Diamond Cutter Sutra. We'll cover that. So that's the meaning of diamond. Anyone who perceives emptiness directly has this experience about a diamond. A diamond comes to be very important for them. Okay, a person might even go to work in a diamond company so he wouldn't forget it. Or stick one in his tooth or something. It's very important. It's very, very important. And it's an experience. And you would, it would be worth your whole life to stay in a company just not to forget it. Just to, every time you wonder why the hell you're there, you would think about it. So it's very, very important. That's the meaning of a diamond. And that's why diamond appears so often in Buddhist philosophy. It represents ultimate reality. And that's a good place to stop. Come and have some tea. Don't be shy, okay? Some people stay in here and they don't want to go. Because you're on your way out. Stream Antura means on your way out. Okay? It'll be 7 lives, it'll be 1 life, it'll be half a life, it'll be 16 lives, but you're on your way out. Once you've seen that directly, first of all, you will never suffer in a major way after that. And then secondly, you achieve nirvana and Buddhahood within a predictable short time. Otherwise, it could be millions of years. Okay, it's a very important moment. So diamond is very important for the title. And somebody put this title on the book. We don't know who. Maybe the Buddha did. You know, yeah.
In Rupa's book on the Dhamma offering, it said that Samyasambhava teacher and Tsongkhapa were all of the same mental continuum. Mm-hmm. And if that's so, then how come when Tsongkhapa took rebirth as in the incarnation of Tsongkhapa, it took him 40 years until he had...
Buddha, according to Mahayana, Lord Shakyamuni Buddha was enlightened before he was born. And he just went through the motions so that we knew, we would find out what to do. Because that's the Mahayana viewpoint, so that's the answer. Okay, we covered diamond, we didn't cover chepa. Okay. Chepa means cutter. Cutter means this, when you have that experience, when you come out, you realize that all the perceptions you ever had in your life, every thought you ever had in your life, everything you ever saw in your life, everything you ever heard in your life, everything you ever had any perception of you in your whole life was mistaken. According to the highest schools of Buddhism, Madhyamika Prasangika, every single perception you had up to that moment, every moment of thought you had was mistaken. And you don't know that until you see emptiness directly. You can understand it logically, but you can't know it until, with direct perception, until you see that. And it's interesting that when you come out of the direct perception of emptiness, the mistaken perception starts again. Okay? You're still under the influence of that old mind. And the moment you come down out of that, the mistaken perceptions begin again. But what's the difference?
You know your mistake.
You know their mistake. So I always say you're like, who was it? Ulysses? They went by the land of the sirens. He wanted to hear what they sounded like. So he told his men in the ship to put wax in their ears so they wouldn't hear it. Because they would sing this beautiful song, and then all the people would row into the cliff and they would die. And he wanted to hear the song. So he said, tie me to the mast, don't put wax in my ears, and don't listen to anything I say. Whatever I order you to do, don't do it after that. And it's this thing where you know you're wrong, but you can't stop yourself. You know, you know your perceptions are mistaken. And that's the meaning of illusion in Buddhism. That's called gyumatabo. After that moment, you know that things are illusory. But you still see them that way. And you can't stop yourself. The day that you do stop yourself, the day that you remove the mental seeds for seeing things wrongly is the day you become enlightened or reach nirvana. Okay? And then you've reached the fifth path. So we missed a path, right? Path number four is from the time that you leave the place where you had your direct perception of emptiness all the way up until the time that you remove the last tiny habit of seeing things that way. And that could take lifetimes. That could take seven lives. So the diamond means, the diamond is ultimate truth. But it can't, the image of a diamond, a physical diamond, is only a representation of ultimate truth. It cannot touch ultimate truth. What you see during those moments of direct perception of emptiness and all your other perceptions forever after, unless you're in the direct perception of emptiness, everything else seems like, you know, wheat before a diamond. You know, it seems like cotton candy before a diamond. Okay? I mean, a diamond is like ultimate, and it just would go through the cotton candy. It's like that comparison. But the diamond itself, the image of a diamond is not, it can't compare really with ultimate reality. That's the why they say cutter. So I'll make it a little clearer here. Cutter means that although diamond does represent ultimate reality very closely, the diamond is totally insufficient to describe what you see. Okay, it's the closest thing. I mean, you could use it to remind yourself of what happened, but it's just totally insufficient. And that's what the cutter means. Okay? You could have called this sutra insufficient diamond. Okay? You could have called it nearly... diamonds are near, but diamonds are close. Okay? But ultimate reality crushes the metaphor of a diamond. Okay? It is no comparison. It's the closest thing in your whole experience to emptiness. If you had to remind yourself of it, what you saw,
You would want to be around diamonds all the time. But it just does not compare. Totally doesn't compare. And that's why the word cutter is in the title. And that's why it's very, very wrong to translate it as Diamond Sutra. The point is that diamonds are insufficient. Okay? The point is that diamonds are close, and diamonds are not very close, okay? Diamonds are the closest thing, but diamonds are totally insufficient to describe what you see. Okay? So if you had to keep something worldly or physical around you to remind you of what you saw, a diamond would be good. But even the highest form of what we call relative truth, relative reality, is not anywhere close to what you saw. I mean, that reality is on a totally separate plane. Ultimate reality is on a totally separate level. And that's another realization you have. I mean, everything, all the other objects you ever see in your life are nothing compared to that. But the diamond is the closest. So that's why we say it cuts the diamond. It smashes the metaphor of the diamond. The diamond is the closest thing, but totally far away. Okay? That's why the word cutter has to be in the title. You have to include that word in the title. It's diamond. It's Dorje Chepa. It's Vajracchedika. Okay, it's not Diamond Sutra. It has a very, very important meaning. That's the meaning of it. It's very, very vital. They didn't know how to cut diamonds when the sutra was spoken. Okay, any questions? I will take questions. Yeah.
You said when you, after you have a direct perception of emptiness and come out of it, all of your future seven lives or whatever will be here.
No great suffering.
Right.
Good circumstances. Lots of Dharma teachings. And there was something else.
Money.
Comfortable. Also, you will keep your morality and stuff like that. You will not have major lapses in your practice.
So my question is, if that's the case, why do high lamas seem to suffer so?
There's a story of Devadatta, his jealous half-brother, who shot a catapult at him. And there was a boulder. He was very jealous of his half-brother. And it hit his foot, and it made a small cut. And there's this tremendous debate in the scriptures about how could a Buddha get a cut. And the conclusion is that he pretended to get a cut. And he pretended to die. Like Rinpoche is pretending to be sick and stay in the hospital and have these horrible things, and people poking him and cutting him, and why would he do it? You know? But when you're his student for 20 years or something, and you go see him helpless on the bed and people cutting him open, and it reminds you of your own impermanence. That's why lamas pretend to be hurt. Okay? If they are enlightened beings, they're not high lamas. I can't judge. I don't know. But there's a precedent for it. You know, the Buddha did.
Not having, you know, or being impoverished, all these circumstances. Yeah. It's just.
Also, you will read a section to answer that question. There will be a section in the Diamond Cutter Sutra where it says anyone who reads this sutra and studies this sutra will, therefore, go through great problems directly after. Stated in the sutra. And there's a reason for that. This has to do with purification. I know that, like, Robin was in Dharamsala. In the early years of the first Western students to study in Dharamsala, where Dalai Lama was, and people used to die. One lady set herself on fire. I mean, horrible things would happen, and it seemed like the best students would have the worst things happen. There's a process of purification. We'll talk about it when we get to that part in the sutra. After that, the class will be in. The idea is that a really tremendously bad karma, such as going to the three lower realms or something, if you understand the sutra fairly well, can be purified in this life. And it would ripen rather quickly. So you would have some small-time bad experience compared to, you know, millions of years in hell. Or you'd have a headache. I mean, that's the scripture says you'd have a bad headache or you could get a backache or something. So, it's actually stated in the Diamond Cutter Sutra. It's probably the source for that teaching. Yeah.
Didn't you say that some great teacher went directly from a lower hell to enlightenment?
The Buddha. I mean, the Buddha, there's a lot of debate about it, but the Buddha himself, according to one scripture, he developed bodhicitta in the hell. He reached that stage. He reached the first bodhisattva, the first moment of bodhicitta in the hell. That's probably what I was talking about. It's a long story. Okay.
As I remember, we don't have to understand Hal Sutra. It's enough to understand four lines of it.
There's a big debate about that. There are some editions of the sutra that say that at the end. And it's not in the original.
Can we hear the question?
He said, there's a part in the sutra which says if you understand four lines of the sutra, you know, that's enough to reach enlightenment. And we'll get to that. We'll talk about that. All right. That's not good. That's probably the most important hour that you'll get in this whole 5 years. Okay? Remember what I said. Okay, very important. All right. Meet Subhuti. Bad light. One of these.
Transformer.
Yeah. There's not going to be an exposure or anything. I mean, this karma is not going to ripen. We haven't read it yet.
I don't think you're writing that fast. Say Subhuti.
Subhuti.
His Tibetan name is Rabdur.
Rabdur.
Okay. Now I'm going to tell you how the sutra starts. And that's all we're going to do tonight. We'll actually get out a little early. There's a monk named Subhuti. The Buddha, Lord Buddha, is... there's a description in the sutra. He gets up, he goes for his morning sunyam. Sunyam means a real Buddhist monk in a real Buddhist country is not allowed to touch money or to keep money or to keep food. And he would go out every morning and beg for his food. The Sanskrit word for monk is bhikshu, and it comes from the word bhikshu, which means to beg. And he would have to go out and ask other people if they think it's worth it that he should be around, continue to be around in the world, you know. And they express that by giving him some food. And that's traditionally how a monk should live. So he goes out, he does his morning food taking, and there's this debate in the commentary, why would he do that? I mean, Buddhists don't have to eat anymore. But he does it for the benefit of the people giving him the food. So they can collect some virtue. And that's the same with offering things. When you make offerings on an altar, they don't drink the water, they don't eat the rice, they don't need an apple. It's mainly the virtue of your offering it. I mean, you're just, Pabonka says, farmers never plant fields for the benefit of the dirt. You know? It's for their own benefit, okay? They're not thinking, oh, I'd like the dirt to be happy, you know. You go out and work for your own benefit. This is when you make offerings, they don't eat it, but it's the act of making an offering. So the Buddha doesn't have to go out and collect his food. But in the sutra, he goes out, he does his sunyam, he comes back, he washes his mouth, you know, it's before teaching, teacher makes his mouth clean. And then he sits down to give a teaching. And the first thing, there are hundreds of monks around, and the monk named Subhuti approaches him, he bows down, he even now in the debate, you saw it when we did the demonstration debate, you take your shawl down, your upper robe as a position of respect for the other person. So the Subhuti comes to the Buddha, he gets down on his knees, he takes off his upper shawl and drops it, and he requests the Buddha for a teaching. And the Buddha, he says to the Buddha, how should a bodhisattva live? How should bodhisattvas conduct themselves? And that's the beginning for the whole sutra. Okay? So Subhuti has come up, and he has made obeisance, and then he asks the Buddha to this question. He says, how should bodhisattvas conduct themselves? How should bodhisattvas live? And the whole Diamond Cutter Sutra is the Buddha's answer. If you cut it into answers and questions, there's 129. And there's this exchange going on between Subhuti and Lord Buddha. So Subhuti plays a major role. This is one of the ways that sutras are taught, is at someone's request. It's a classic way that someone requests the teaching. So Subhuti is asking Lord Buddha a question, and then they continue to have this conversation. Subhuti asks questions, the Buddha asks questions of Subhuti, and they give each other answers, questions and answers back and forth. It's very, very beautiful. It's really beautiful. And you have this exchange going on. You know the Heart Sutra. Who taught the Heart Sutra? This is a big debate in the monastery. Who taught the Heart Sutra? It's a sutra, right?
Buddha.
So he says Buddha. Okay. Who spoke the Heart Sutra?
Buddha.
He doesn't say anything. At the end he says, Legso, Legso, Dideshina, Dideshin, Dejidokikinam, Dejin, Shirogipavichin, Lapshin. He doesn't say anything. He's in meditation during the whole sutra. It's two of his students talking with each other. Okay, the whole Heart Sutra. But actually, they're like puppets. He's running the show mentally. With his mental power, he's making one ask questions, and he's making the other one answer. They're like dolls. They're under his control mentally. And that's the beauty of the whole Heart Sutra. He's running the show. Okay? So it's actually one enlightened being getting two humans to talk to each other. You really did well. This sutra is very similar. Okay? The Tibetan commentator says that Subhuti is Manjushri. Subhuti is a tantric deity. So essentially, you have one enlightened being pretending to be a bodhisattva and asking questions to another enlightened being. And that's how the sutra goes. The evidence of that is that Subhuti speaks many of the Prajnaparamita sutras. The Buddha at the beginning says, Subhuti, what do you think? And Subhuti starts talking. And they are the Prajnaparamita sutras. They're recorded and they're added to the Prajnaparamita literature. And they're perfect. The meaning is perfect. And, you know, you can recognize it. It sounds like enlightenment. Yeah.
Excuse me, but the Tibetan commentator
Choni Chokpa Yeah. Sometimes called Chonin Lama. Yeah. Which means the Lama from Chonin. That was his birthplace. So that sets the scene. And we're going to stop there. I have to hand out one more thing. Let me get your homework. But you've got the scene set there. And we'll start the sutra next class. Let me make sure I cover everything. That's it. In your meditation, we study in the monastery from 9 to 12 years, we study Abhisamayalankara, Maitreya's work on perfection of wisdom. And then you do a special ceremony, and then you go into, you're supposed to do a meditation retreat to build up enough virtue to study this subject. Study emptiness, before you're allowed to crack a Madhyamika book, before you're allowed to study a book about emptiness, you have to finish 9 to 12 years of studying the monastery, and then you have to go into a meditation retreat, just to get the virtue to study this book. And so what I'd like you to do in your meditation is just to do what we call a sundep. Yeah. Sundep means during your meditation, 15 minutes this week, just sit down and pray to the lamas who have taught this subject. Okay? Means it goes back to Subhuti and Buddha. Okay? If you're interested, you can get a list of the lamas, the gurus and the lamas in the chain. It's called the Samultawegyu. The whole chain of teachers, the person that I learned it from, the person that he learned it from, the person that he learned it from, it goes back to the Buddha. There is an unbroken chain for this teaching back to the Buddha. So, as you do your meditation, there is no meditation. Just pray to them. Okay, just try to imagine those beings, Nagarjuna, and the people who came after Tsongkhapa, people who came after me. Try to ask them for their blessing. Okay, this subject is very tricky. Madhyamika emptiness. When you study these books, it's very tricky. 100 people can read the same book. They can have the same teaching. 50 of them don't know what the heck it's all about. 50 of them, they sit there and nothing happens. It sounds interesting or it sounds boring, but nothing clicks. And then in a certain number, it just clicks. and they just blow up. Something happens. In the Chandrakirti says you start weeping, or your spine tingles, or your hairs rise up. I mean, if you have a jinlap, you'll catch it, and something will happen. If you don't have a jinlap, nothing will happen. This is a jinlap. Okay, jinlap means you really make a true request this week. Spend 15 minutes in the morning. You know, you spend that much time on breakfast or going to the bathroom, or whatever. Okay, it's not much time. 15 minutes is nothing. But spend 15 minutes and just mentally request for the blessing to catch it. Okay, and if you catch it, it's fantastic. If you don't catch it, you know, you got to see it anyway. All right. To do this meditation, you have to have a book that most people have. It's called the Yunden Shigirma, or Source of All My Good. You have to read that before you do that request. If you don't have it, take one from here. Okay? It's 10 pages long. It's in here. I think most people have a copy. If you don't have a copy, take one. You can read the English translation here. Just read it out loud before you do your meditation. It's very important. Okay, let's chanting master. Are you ready? And this is probably the only time you'll get out early, I think.